Good morning, how are you? Very welcome to the show. And I think the overview of the papers on this bank holiday weekend would be that everybody is fighting with everybody about everything. So first up is the front of the Mail, and I suppose you'd characterise this as poor old Corina Butler and NIAC versus everybody else. Their headline is "Speed up the booster rollout to stop jab waste." So staff and vaccination centres face a race against time, they say, to use thousands of vaccines that are just days from expiring. And they're pushing again the notion that the healthcare workers need to get their boosters ASAP. There's only 100,000 boosters done, they say in there, which would strike you as very little. And then they also, I think it goes broader than that. They have Niall Collins is inside, and Leo Varadkar, both more or less saying we need to be rolling out boosters for everybody, rolling it down the population at this stage. And that's the answer to this, and people citing Israel and that. The Sunday Times, that is the publicans and the nighttime economy versus the government. And confusion reigns in the hospitality industry this weekend over proposals to require nightclubs, music venues and late bars to have this is the ticketing. So there seems to be confusion over whether bars need to have ticketing, and people pointing out that a late bar is a bar up to a point, and, you know, do you throw everyone out then and make them have booked tickets 24 hours in advance and so on. The Business Post are pointing out there are other catastrophes facing us apart from the COVID. Climate targets already in doubt as emissions to increase this year. So basically, like, we heard during the week that we shut down the whole economy last year and emissions went down by 3.6%, which isn't like half what we're going to be needing to drop them by every year. And now it turns out that they're going to go up this year, and they're going to go up next year as well. And then it's from 2023 we're going to start what was already a steep kind of move down to get them cut by 50% by 2030. So that's that. I'm going to go out on a limb here and make a prediction that we won't make it. The Sunday Independent, more catastrophe, cabinet briefed on power cut threat. This isn't the first, obviously, we've heard about potential power supply issues over the summer. So they're saying now that power cuts in family homes cannot be ruled out over the winter due to significant supply issues. And they also have nation braces for another COVID wave as infighting and errors are revealed. And that's a very interesting book that we will come back to, which is the kind of soap opera in a way around the handling of NPHET. The Mirror has a story about Philip Cairns. The Sunday World has that a Kinahan cartel mobster, Graham the Whig Whelan, lines out for McGregor's Black Forge pub team, a match made in heaven there. The Irish Sun on Sunday has a very powerful front page, and it is "The future holds nothing for me, it's bleak." And this is Tommy Malone. He's 68. He lives a terrible existence on his weekly pension of €211.40. "The future holds nothing for me, it's bleak. If I was to look at the future, I'd be better off dead," he says. "I've nothing to look forward to." Now, our panel this morning, Nora Casey is a broadcaster and publisher. Kevin Doyle is the group head of news at INM. And Dr. Ilona Duffy is a GP from Monaghan. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Morning.
Before we get stuck into the papers, can I ask you all, I went out on last Sunday night for a bite to eat and had a few drinks, I will confess. But everything was being done properly in the place that I was in and everything. Three of us from three different households and everything, and it felt fine at the time. And on Monday, I started reading the papers again and going, God, you know, I probably wouldn't do that again. And on Tuesday, I was thinking, why did I go out on Sunday night? And I was kind of almost slightly nervous and stuff. Are you finding your taking in your horns a little bit in the last week, Nora? Are you starting to kind of make your life a bit smaller again?
My life, unfortunately, involves speaking a lot at events, so I feel I've been out and about an awful lot since I was in Portugal for 2 weeks. And funnily, they, on October the 1st, they opened up the same as what we were supposed to open up on Friday. And everyone still wore masks. Like, you know, we were all walking around and people were saying, you know, you don't have to wear the masks. And we were saying, we feel more comfortable wearing them. And so was everyone else. And when I mentioned this to a nurse friend of mine, she said that wouldn't happen in Ireland. If they said on Friday, you can take your mask off, everybody would have taken their masks off.
I wonder, Kevin, what do you do? I sense it from a lot of people that they are kind of gone back into a place of slight fear, hearing about COVID around the place, people they know getting it and everything, and that actually it might work, that people are kind of pulling in their horns a little bit.
A little bit, Brendan. I feel like I'm living in a parallel universe, and I can flip from one side of it to the other. And I think that's a coping mechanism side.
Yeah.
So on one hand, I'm looking at those queues outside Coppers and all the nightclubs, which I was not in. But I'm kind of looking and going, yeah, fair enough. Go for it. Like, you know, there's this idea that life has been on hold or life has been on pause. That's not actually true. Life is passing us by. We've lost a year and a half and we're looking at another half a year possibly gone as well. So I'm looking at those pictures and going, yeah. And then at the same time, I'm able to compartmentalize this other part of my brain, which is going, but God, Christmas is 62 days away. Will I be able to see the family for Christmas the way things are going, kind of thing? So I think there's an element of we've put up with doing so little for so long that you kind of have to step out, a bit like you going for your lunch with your friends. But it's very worrying at the same time. So there's no right answer, I think.
Where do you think people are at, Ilona?
Well, I suppose I'm in Monaghan most of the time, where things are fairly good. People are being scanned and screened going into pubs, restaurants, everything like that. But I came to Dublin last week and with my kids to go to the launch of Arachs, a movie. And I couldn't believe it. We were on the Lewis and not even a quarter of the people on it were wearing masks. We kind of walked through Temple Bar and into a couple of shops. And when we looked at that, and it was my kids that pointed it out to me, I kind of hadn't really noticed. And they were saying, nobody's wearing masks on the Lewis. In the shops, people with masks pulled down below their noses. So I think very definitely we're seeing people kind of, there's a bit of the COVID fatigue. People are kind of not taking it as seriously. I think those who are at risk are taking it seriously. Mm. And definitely those who are older are saying, you know, I'm nearly afraid to go into the shops again because I'm seeing the numbers rise.
Back to that. Back to that.
I would say, just to say, since I came back, I felt that there were loads of places, to be honest, I was going into and I had to say, do you want to check my COVID vaccination? They weren't asking anybody. There were loads of events that I thought, how on earth are they able to do this, you know, under the current guidelines? Since Friday, everybody's checking. In the run-up to Friday even, I saw a noticeable difference that everybody was checking vaccinations.
Yeah, I think there'd be a sharp
I was in Blanchardstown yesterday. Yeah. My mum is 91 and I see her every Saturday and she always does her shopping with me. So we went to Blanchardstown to a very well-known retailer. I never do this, Brendan, never. I'm just one of those people who kind of removes themselves from situations. But she wanted something and I got into a huge long queue. There was no disinfectant at the door. The people behind me were nearly on top of me. Every time I moved forward in the queue and I was distant from the woman in front, two people behind me were nearly breathing down my neck. And I turned around and very politely said, do you mind giving me some social distance? They were not happy, really angry. My mum was in a wheelie, so she's sitting, like, you know, in a disability chair, people brushing up against her. You know, it was not good. I did say to the girl at the counter, you know, this isn't good. You shouldn't do this. I would be very wary of taking her now to the shops again.
Yeah. No, the thing is, most of the population, vast majority, vaccinated and everything. But I suppose what we're being told now very clearly is that vaccination does not stop transmission, Ilona.
I think that's the scary thing. And every day we have positive cases again in the surgery. And we're one practice, but every day a minimum of two. And we're not getting all the positive results because anyone who self-refers for their testing, the results don't always come to us. So we're reliant maybe on them ringing us. They need a social welfare cert or a note for work. And we now know the data is showing that even being vaccinated doesn't reduce your infectivity to others. So we are seeing people who are doubly vaccinated. I even had a couple who had COVID in January and are doubly vaccinated.
So they would have super immunity.
One would presume. They've both tested positive. One of the couple, quite unwell, not unwell enough to need hospital, but really feeling awful, feeling short of breath, back to that. So I think that it just hasn't gone away. And in a way, I suppose we were promised that, you know, be vaccinated and it's all going to be fine. And the sad reality is that we're learning all the time and we're seeing that the immunity does wane after a period of time and that we're going to require boosters for those who
are risk. Which brings us to the booster story there on the front of the Mail. What was your view on that? I presume, number one, you would feel, as everyone seems to feel, that the healthcare workers need to get boosters straight away.
Well, the data seem to be suggesting that younger healthcare workers without any underlying health conditions might not need it, let's say, for themselves, for their own health needs. But I think what we're now seeing is that this week we saw 1,800 healthcare workers out sick as a result of COVID, and that is impacting on our healthcare system. So it's back to protecting the system. And to do that, we're going to have to booster dose all our healthcare workers to ensure they don't test positive and that they're not at home and not infecting others in work and leading to that mushroom effect. So we're going to have to do that.
OK, so and Tony Holohan has made this point. Like, look, I think Rena Butler is known as a woman, a very precise woman and a very scientific woman and a woman of integrity and everything. He made the point that the evidence, as you say, for giving them to younger healthcare workers is unclear, but the point you're making is that it's not for their sake, even possibly. It's just not to have it.
It's not to have it, and it's not to have them at work potentially infecting patients. And again, when you see this article that's in the Mail and talking about, you know, vaccines in the vaccine centres about to go out of date in the next few days, we need to be doing something fast about this. We know now that they have issued guidance that those who are over 60 should all be getting a booster dose. No plan has been put in place yet.
Are you doing boosters?
We're doing. GPs were asked to do boosters for the over 80s. But again, it's proving difficult. Number one, it's proving difficult to get the vaccines. We have a large cohort of older patients, and I think we had something like we had about 400 patients over the age of 80. We haven't been able to get enough vaccines. This Thursday, we're to get six vials. That's 36 vaccines.
Okay.
So we have no hope of getting them done in a fast way. But as
are there supply issues there? Yeah.
I don't know. We don't really know. We're not getting answers on that. But then we see in this article,
but you could be using lots more vaccines than you're getting.
Well, we could, but also we've got to look at the fact that if we want the GPs to be doing it, we've got to realise that that's going to bump other work. So we're probably busier than ever, and it's with the non-COVID stuff. It is with the healthcare issues that have built up over the last year and a half. The fact that the hospitals aren't back at full capacity, clinics aren't happening, tests are being delayed. So we're having to pick up the pieces there and see people whose health is deteriorating. And, you know, this is where we need to be kind of saying, well, if you're in an age group, I think the age group would be easy. So all those over 60s, if you're over 60 and it's 6 months since your second dose, you can present, once you've proof your ID of your date of birth and your vaccine card to show that it's 6 months, and go and use these vaccines. Like the thoughts that we could be losing.
Look, if it has to be buses going out to places, you get them out there was always the way to do this, wasn't it? Get them out there. Are your immunocompromised patients all boosted yet?
No, and again, the immunocompromised patients are, the lists of those are being arranged through the hospital setting at the moment. So it's hit and miss. I have patients who've told me, yes, I've been referred and I have been vaccinated, others who haven't heard anything. And at the moment, we're not able to vaccinate those. We're vaccinating the over 80s.
Would it make more sense for you to be vaccinating? You know your patients.
We do, but actually, you know, even to try and get them in and try and do that, I think the biggest and easiest way is to open it up and say, you know who you are, arrive with proof and you'll be vaccinated, and stop the delays. Stop, you know, having us having to go searching them, having to ring them, having to try and get them in, having to arrange extra clinics. And similarly for the hospitals who did this the last time, they did most of the at-risk group in the hospital setting. But we have set up these vaccine centres.
So now we have hospitals making up the lists, sending them into the HSE, and then everyone waits. Whereas you're saying the hospitals could just take their own lists.
Well, we don't want to be giving it to the hospitals either. We have vaccine centres. The whole aim of opening up these centres, they would do this work, and it wouldn't therefore be impacting either on primary care or on the hospital setting.
And we should remember as well, am I right in thinking that the immunocompromised people are not getting a booster as we understand it? They're getting a third jab to bring them up, just to catch up with the rest of us, isn't it?
Yes, because we know that those who are older and those who are on certain medications, they will not maintain their immunity.
Okay, put on your headphones there, guys, and I want to talk to Jack Lambert, Professor of Infectious Diseases at UCD. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning.
Jack, can we start on the booster issue then? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I was asked 2 months ago, who should we be boosting? And I just kind of said, all the nursing home people who died last year, they're high risk. All the immunocompromised, and all the healthcare workers. And I'm 67, for the record. I get my last dose the 26th of January. And I've read the scientific data that the vaccine that I got, levels drop off after 6 months.
Was it AstraZeneca?
You know, I got the Pfizer vaccine.
Okay.
And, you know, that data has been available from the UK and from Israel from July.
And we now have studies showing that you would be bumped back up to 94.5%. Is that correct with a third dose of Pfizer?
Yeah, and I'm on the wards. I was in the hospital today. I was on the wards with COVID patients, and you know, I'm just saying. We've known this for a long time, and I guess it just goes to say, who's planning ahead for this pandemic? It doesn't matter if it's testing or hospitality or booster vaccinations. We need to be on top of booster vaccinations and make it easy and make it quick. And we've done nothing easy and we've done nothing quick in this country with any of the COVID, you know, strategies that we've undertaken over the last 19 months.
Yeah, but I suppose, Jack, let's say in fairness as well that they have been dealing with a pandemic which continues to confound us, and that, you know, 3 weeks ago we thought we were close to suppressing it, and it's roaring back.
Who thought we were close to suppressing it? It was that we're going to be 95% vaccinated and we're going to throw caution to the wind going into the winter. That was a bad decision, a bad message to give to the Irish public in the first place, you know. So I mean, there's no defense for this. If you look at every other country, their experience, the experience is not that we're going to open up the country going into winter once we've got 90% vaccination. Vaccination helps tremendously, but it's not eliminating COVID. We've known this for months.
Okay, so where are you at then on opening up the country? Because you have been an advocate for, look, we have to get on with our lives here, but we do it safely. Is that still where you'd be in your thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I put together in Irish Times 10 steps for living safely with COVID, and it's all of those things we've talked about. Vaccinations are making a huge difference. We should be doing it and doing it rapidly, and all the other COVID prevention stuff, we've never really emphasized it, and we've given lip service to it. We need to kind of re-emphasize it and enforce it.
Yeah, okay. Jack, will you stay with us? And there's obviously a few other aspects of COVID we want to go through, so you're happy to stay there and we'll just talk with the panel and I'll come back to you. So, Kevin, the next issue that's on the papers today, I suppose, one of the other issues, we've come to nightclubs, etc., is you've picked out a piece in the Sunday Times about schools. And this is obviously a huge issue that's going on in every community in the country now, between head teachers on the sly doing confidential kind of contact tracing, ringing people and saying, look, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but WhatsApp groups doing it. We're back to that situation.
Yeah, and the teacher unions are pleading in some cases, it seems, for the government to go backwards on this, because it does seem that a decision was taken to stop contact tracing. And
Because they were only getting something like 4% positivity among contacts in the schools, and they just felt that if you balance that out against a load of healthy kids being sent home, it wasn't worth it.
Yeah, that basically kids were missing a week, 10 days of school, and that it was rife, and basically whole classrooms were effectively being shut down, and there was no way to teach those kids half remote, half in the classroom, and that basically the trade-off was it wasn't worth it. But I think the problem here in some ways, and this is reflected in a few stories in the papers today, is that when you stop that contact tracing, the kids who do get it, that 4 or 5%, are bringing that home, and then adults are getting it in the household, and the adults are then spreading it, be it in the pub or in the workplace or just going about their business. And so the schools do seem to feel like they have kind of just been left out there as the wild west of COVID tracing, because we talk about the idea that we have all these weapons in our armory. And we've had this kind of battle talk since the very, very start of COVID, and that we had all these different ways, and would antigen tests was just one idea, and social distancing was another, and hand sanitizing was another. And then when it came to schools, they seemed to drop some of the armory. And I think that has really upset the teachers. It has upset the unions. Yeah. And to be fair, it is hard to see. There could be another way, you would imagine, which would be to perhaps do the contact tracing but maybe not have the same rules around isolation. But at least,
but I think they, I think they're applying a standard public health model to it. So there still is contact tracing and everything, but it's just possibly not being done as automatically as it was. Nora, what do you think?
Well, I think that most of our conversation today and for quite some time has been around process and management. Like we're just sitting here with, you know, my GP colleague saying she doesn't have enough booster vaccinations, and in the papers it says they're going to go out of date within minutes. I was in favour of dropping contact tracing in school. I felt if we'd only a limited amount of people that were in the, you know, the coal face of trying to manage this nationally, we had to let go of something. Was it worth it to spend all those hours and hours doing contact tracing? What was the end result? Or could we do it somehow a different way? I know it was chaotic in the early days of the schools reopening. Everyone of my colleagues were, they were working, they were at home, they had kids at home at the last minute, their child was sent home for a week. So it was very, very difficult, I think, for them to plan anything or do anything in the household, and that's not good for the child either. You may as well go back to virtual schooling.
So Jack, is there a middle ground here with schools? Are there some mitigation measures we could put into, say, primary schools that wouldn't be as extreme as sending all the kids who weren't sick home, but that wouldn't be that would be more agreeable to teachers and everybody else involved?
Well, you know, there's no easy answers in all of this, you know. It's important to keep schools open and to keep schools open safely. And there's been lots of outbreaks in schools, lots of outbreaks in kids. So you know, absolutely you don't wear a mask, and kids should not be wearing masks in school when they're sitting in classroom.
They should. You're saying no masks for primary school kids, no?
I agree with that. But how about when they're coming to school? There are situations where you can use a mask, you know, if they're going in public transportation, if they're carpooling, if they're going out to the toilet. So masks still have a role. Some schools have done antigen testing, piloting, you know, to decrease the number of cases, you know, of kids out of school positive for COVID. That's been done successfully in some places, so you can't rule that out. And then like I said, obviously, if you're symptomatic, you shouldn't be going to school. And there needs to be, you know, there's lots of, it's a very leaky system. I'm not sure that people are screening, you know, as well as you should be. So there's lots of different modalities in terms of COVID prevention that should be looked at in the school. I don't feel like I'm an expert in all of those areas, but so that's as far as I could comment.
Okay. Ilona, what are you saying?
Okay. So I think it was a huge mistake to stop the complete contact tracing. I agree we couldn't have children out for a fortnight or asymptomatic, knowing that the data showed that most of them didn't develop COVID, and what could happen is a week later they were re-exposed and out for another fortnight. So we had to do something about that. But we had examples of how it was being managed just north of the border, where if you were a close contact, you had a test and you could return if it was negative, and you were asked to have another test at day 10. So there are ways of doing this. But I think the fact that we've now moved to a situation where you could have a positive case in your child's classroom, and you're not informed about that. So you don't realise that your child has that increased possibility of developing COVID. And perhaps you live with elderly relatives, or you visit elderly relatives who are immunocompromised. You've no way of saying, well, do you know what? We're going to keep Johnny or Mary from them for the next fortnight. And also it will increase your...
Do you not think in reality teachers are telling people?
Well, I think some of the teachers are really afraid to, because guidance was issued that this wasn't to be discussed, and that it was a breach of confidentiality and GDPR, and that it wasn't, you know, parents were being advised not to discuss it on WhatsApp
groups. I actually spoke to one principal during the week who said he did his own contact tracing, and the HSE rang him 5 days later after they had first known that a child in the class had... Three of the children that he had contact traced himself turned out to be positive cases on the back of that, because they'd all been playing outside of school. And he got a slap on the wrist from the HSE for having done it himself.
See, that's not good enough. We have to allow the information to be there. And again, we know that there are lots of other viruses out there. There's been lots about RSV and the other adenoviruses and things. So lots of parents are ringing us and saying, oh, so-and-so's sick. I know it's not COVID. And you've got to say, well, we don't know it's not COVID until you have a negative COVID test if you have symptoms. But I think that is creeping in as well. Well, they always cough at this time of the year because they have asthma. And that feeling, well, you know, it's probably, and it is probably not COVID, because there's a surge in all the other viruses. But the reality of it is that if parents are aware there's COVID in the school, they will be much more likely to take their child for testing immediately, and not perhaps give the Calpol, give the Nurofen and send them on in, hoping that they're okay. Because people aren't doing it deliberately. They genuinely feel the numbers are so low in school. They're listening to the message that's coming from public health saying, oh, it doesn't spread as much in school. There aren't that many outbreaks. The positivity rate is so low.
Which is true. Yeah.
But then that is translating as, well, we don't really have to worry about it amongst our kids. Yeah. And we do, because children still can become infected and can bring it home and reinfect those who are vaccinated and others.
By the way, Nina Burns, who's GP here in Dublin, seemed to be saying to me yesterday that there is something very infectious going around, which has very COVID-like symptoms, and which if one person in the family gets it, the whole family seems to get it, but that they're not testing positive for COVID. Have you experienced that?
I've had it in my own house.
Really?
So, yeah, you know, there's a very nasty virus going around. And we figure, talking to paediatric colleagues about some of the younger children who are admitted, it seems to be this RSV virus.
Yeah.
But all viruses will tend to present with the same type of symptoms, cough, snuffles, sore throat, temperature, perhaps vomiting and diarrhea. So the big thing is you can't say it's not COVID unless you have a negative COVID test.
Yeah. And if you have a negative COVID test, we're 100% positive it's not COVID then?
Well, we're not. But
I heard a doctor on the BBC last night say that his whole family got wiped out with something. He seemed like quite a sensible guy. They tested negative, and then suddenly he tested positive first, and then I think the rest of the family tested positive, but that they were sick for days before
but
this.
The message goes back to even, it doesn't matter if it's COVID, if your child is sick or you're sick, don't expose others to it. And I think over the years, we've gotten this kind of feeling of, you know, get into work, you've got to do it, you don't want to be letting your colleagues down, even if you're a bit sick, go in. I think COVID has changed all of that, and we're realising we have that personal responsibility that Neffet have talked about, not only for COVID, but other infections.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack, so the big change this weekend, I suppose, was the opening up of the nighttime economy and the clubs and everything else. Are you concerned about that in any way?
Well, no, I think we should open up the clubs back in July and August, you know, and prepare appropriately for it, not wait until almost November when winter's coming with all the other respiratory illnesses. I listened to Euronews on Friday and they were interviewing somebody from Ireland saying, don't you think it's embarrassing that you've opened up the nightclubs and you've got no guidance on what to do? And the fellow went and said, oh, sure, but we'll deal with it. Well, you shouldn't have to. This should be planned months ahead of time. But I think, Jack, in fairness,
they have had to, like, regroup and scramble and stuff and everything else, and it has sometimes been a bit bumpy, as the T-shirt says, and then things do settle down. And, like, in fairness, you know, we have a good record in this country on dealing with COVID, and I know we're probably not number one on the Bloomberg COVID resilience ranking anymore, but we were, and our death rates are among the lowest in Europe. So I think let's just be careful about just being all critical about everything. We've done a lot of things right in this country.
But the deal is, this is an emergency pandemic, and you know we could plan ahead and have guidance out ahead of time. We didn't have guidance for school opening in September. We didn't have, you know, time and time again, we'd be behind the eight ball. And you keep on defending the indefensible, as far as I'm concerned.
But it's not the indefensible.
I think we should open up. I agree.
Okay.
I think we should open up safely. And all of the COVID mitigating strategies that are part of that, which are, you know, the hand washing, the vaccine passport, the masks in appropriate situations are going to be. And then even after people leave the nightclub, when they go home for the weekend to their families, they need to be aware that they need to take additional precautions so they don't bring COVID back from the nightclub home to family members who are immunocompromised.
A lot of people now are kind of saying quietly to each other and to themselves, are we going to see a bump in 2 weeks' time in cases?
I think the numbers will increase. Of course they will. They would increase. Of course they're going to increase. But the deal
will increase anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, there are things we can do to keep it down, rather than just saying, you know, vaccines are the saving grace. They're one part of the solution. We need to give the Irish public that all the other things are important. And even if the numbers do go up, you know, lockdown is not a solution as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, having ICU beds that are, you know, under-resourced in Ireland for the last 10 years, that's not an excuse for lockdown. It's a good reason for us to do everything right and really emphasize that to the Irish public.
Jack, before you go, you know, we have two ways of thinking about this, which is sometimes we're thinking, OK, it's going away now and sure, it'll stay around, but it'll be like a mild cold and we'll get on with our lives. And then we're back in the other space, I feel, in the last week where we're thinking things like, OK, this is actually going to be with us forever and it's going to flare up and down and it's going to be something we're going to live with for some years. Is that the reality of it?
I think it is, you know. Yeah. I think we thought 18 months ago that it was an animal virus that would die out in humans. It seems to be getting stronger in humans, and it seems to be mutating quicker than even flu. So we're just going to have to accept that flu, we get annual vaccines. With COVID, we might need vaccines every 6 months, and we might just need to live with this moving forward. And I think that's the mindset we should take, mistakenly.
Okay, Professor Jack Lambert, your line's getting very bad there. Thanks very much. I'll come back to the panel on the nightclub story. You've all picked, I noticed, the front page of the Sunday Times, Pub Furious, that mixed messages on COVID contact tracing rules in Ireland. Nora, kick us off on this.
Well, I think, so it goes back to, firstly, I agree with Jack on the fact that I don't know why we don't have guidance in advance for everything, and there should have been. This isn't something that was, you know, hitting people at the last minute. So there should have been guidance.
Well, it was now. Let's be fair.
But
here.
Even with the
but hang on, just to be fair, the government is making the point that the plan as of a week ago was that these places were going to be opening up, and this was the plan. 3 weeks ago, the government were being told that we are close to suppressing this. So it did change for them all.
Their calculus completely changed. Brendan, you talk about it like as though you need months to do these things. I'm telling you, a group of, you know, great thinkers could sit around the table and by lunchtime they would have had the guidance worked out.
And a group of great thinkers did sit around. They sat around a few times this week with the hospitality industry and they all
I know you're playing devil's advocate and I admire it, but I still think the whole issue
I'm not. I'm injecting some balance into this conversation here.
But when you're,
that's what I'm doing, Nora.
What the pub industry are saying is, it goes back to, are you out or are you out? And everybody in Ireland often goes out and doesn't expect to be out. So they're saying you could be sitting in a pub and then they'd have a late night DJ coming on. Are they expected to have tickets in advance for that? How do they go around the whole pub and get them to sign up for tickets?
Wouldn't people be as well off going home at that point?
I totally agree with them, but at the end of the day,
the ones who've been out that long, possibly should be a change of shift there.
One thing on the other side.
Send home the early shift and bring in the late shift.
On the other side, I would just say that we have created, you know, a kind of, it goes back to personal responsibility. I think the hospitality and the pub industry could have come up with some plans themselves rather than moaning on the sidelines. And I'm one of their biggest defenders. But I did feel in this regard, given that, as you say, a week out, it's like, oh, maybe we won't be opening up. Let's all get together. Let's come up with some plans. Let's put in some suggestions. And rather than sitting on the sidelines throwing bricks saying, you know, why did you not think of the ticket thing in advance? Why didn't you tell us to the last minute? They could have been a bit proactive themselves, you know.
Kevin, is it a case that every time anything changes, everyone starts going, oh, it's all so confusing and oh, the rules are a shambles and all this. And then like 2 days later, everything's working. As Micheál Martin pointed out, there was holy war over the vaccine passports for about a week, like, and then suddenly just settled down and
now we all
more
or less support them. Yeah, I've become a bit sanguine about this because we've all got outraged at various stages and we've blamed everyone from the joggers to the young people to all the way along. There's been somebody to blame throughout this. And I have some sympathy for the government. I mean, they've made a hames of a lot of things, but I do have some sympathy for the battle that they're facing now in terms of what the pubs and clubs are saying to them, because the alternative is, lads, they could have left you shut. And I think there's an awful lot of this people in the country that would have backed them if they had left the pubs shut, given what we're hearing from Ilona and Jack Lambert and others this weekend. So,
but yeah. I think what the CMO has pointed out is that if we don't do it now, there's no time in the immediate future when they're
we're into
it
spring.
Like, and there are people there who haven't been open for
years. I'm not saying that I necessarily would like to see them stay shut. I think people have to get back to jobs and then we have to get back to life. But it is, I think there also has to be an acceptance here. The government are trying to put in mitigating measures because the reality is, as Shane Ross's headline says, with the Miles hyperbole that only Shane Ross can ever apply to his column, people don't go clubbing to obey rules, they go to get blotto. And the reality is, anybody who thinks there is going to be socially distant queues at bars in nightclubs hasn't been out since they lined up on opposite sides of Lanigan's Ball. Like, it's just not a thing. It's never going to work. In fact, I've kind of transitioned, Brendan, into kind of old man a little bit during lockdown, because back in the before COVID world, BC, I bit like Nora's talking about, I'd have been prone to go out for 3 or 4 and come home at 3 or 4 instead. And the idea when they were going to make have tables in nightclubs and table service in nightclubs, I was going, oh, I could still go to nightclubs. And then it was like, no, it's back to this free for all thing. I was like, no, I'm done. I'm as my wife said, look at them in the queue. They're not a coat between them. Never mind a mask. And so
I think, you know, they say a pandemic presses fast forward on a lot of things.
Yeah, like, I'm going to have to wait for my midlife crisis now before my next nightclub outing, perhaps. But look, I have sympathy for the government on that one. And I think you're right, Brendan. I think they'll figure out a technological way that you can go into an app and you can go, I want to go to bar X, and you can go there 5 minutes later and we'll all get over ourselves.
But why do we even need that? I don't understand why we need it. We already have the technology where I've been asked to show my COVID pass and my little code thing, and it's zapped. It's scanned. So surely you're gathering that. That's proving it's Ilona Duffy, and then they asked to see my passport or whatever. So surely that data has already been captured. And why can't it go into a system?
Are they allowed to capture that data?
But that's where you seek consent and you say, okay, to go into the nightclub, you're going to have to, it'll be kept for 14 days.
Yeah.
So we already have that there.
Yeah.
If we're talking about
should we be talking more about ventilation? I feel like a dog with a bone here slightly, but like, I've spoken to a few publicans and they're saying, why is there no conversation around ventilation? That's the difference between, you can have 1,500 people in one place and 1,500 people, you know, in a different place, and one's a super spreader event but the other could be much safer.
I don't know, unless it's outside, they're all going to be at risk. And yes, it depends how jammed and how sardined they are, but the reality of it is, if you're close together, even in an outside setting with just a tent on top of you, a rooftop on top of you, you're still going to be at risk at spreading if COVID is there. So I think we shouldn't get too lost on the numbers, and we should be kind of accepting, yes, we're opening up and we will see a rise. But the government will have predicted this. I mean, Philip Nolan, every now and then his figures are quoted at us and we're given the worst case scenario. I think in some ways that's not a great message, because people get immune to that and desensitised. So instead of hearing, oh my gosh, by Christmas we could have, actually one of the articles talking about it, within the next few weeks we could have 6,000 positive cases a day and it'd be hoped by Christmas that'd be down to 3,000. Those kind of figures don't mean anything to people anymore, because they're hearing these doomsday figures all the time, and then it's not actually happening. So that feeling of, let's scare them into doing what they're meant to do, and, you know, is wearing off. And it definitely is wearing off when we're seeing the queues outside nightclubs with people not wearing masks, not socially distancing.
All vaccinated, though.
Well, not everybody in those queues. People will be arriving hoping they'll get to scoot in without being seen, or meet with the friends and stand outside and wait on them.
But so, we've agreed that's not going to happen anymore now. Sure, it's not. It was happening up to a few days ago, but it's all changed now. Kevin, before we go to the break, I mentioned earlier that so Richard Chambers of Virgin Media has a book, and it's from the extract that's in the Sunday Indo. It's going to be a great book, because he seems to have got behind the scenes and down and dirty with all the major players, Neffet and everything. They've all sung like canaries to him, and he kind of has the inside story on things.
Yeah, I know people are suffering from COVID fatigue, which is its own thing, but it is kind of, if you read one thing about COVID today, I'd suggest that it is this, because it is the Coronation Street of COVID. And it's a chapter about that big row that everyone remember when Leo Varadkar went on the Claire Byrne show and basically blasted Neffet out of it. And at the time, everybody on all sides said, oh, no, we're all fine. We're all best friends. There's no big rows here behind the scenes. Trust us, it'll all be grand. And what we see in this is them absolutely ripping shreds off one another. And it occurs to me that they must have thought the pandemic would be over by now and that we'd have all moved on with our lives, because you have Philip Nolan talking about how the communications between Neffet and the government completely broke down over that period. We learned that Colm Henry from the HSE told Tony Holohan that he'd blown it in the way that he had handled it. We learned that apparently in the background, everybody in Neffet is calling Tony Holohan the boss. And I'm not sure whether they mean that in a nice way, in the way that you just referred to the boss or not.
Yeah. And he hasn't steered us badly now, in fairness.
Eamon Ryan talks about a sense of betrayal in the way that Neffet approached that, telling us that last October that we needed to go to level 5, and people will remember that famously the government only went to level 3 and then a few weeks later.
Yeah. And that, it got leaked out on the Sunday to the papers, and the country went into a state of absolute shock, and the government felt blindsided by it. And then, of course, it's that story all around Leo Varadkar going on Claire Byrne that night as well.
Yeah, and he, I mean, it was a kind of, I was actually there that night, Brendan, and it was kind of extraordinary television because I was waiting in the wings and you're kind of going, is this really happening? And then you're like, are people at home seeing this? Maybe he's just doing this here in studio before it actually goes out. And Leo Varadkar actually rang Tony Holohan, we learned today, after that to talk about what he had said, because they had obviously, when Leo Varadkar was the Taoiseach, they had had a much closer relationship than when he became Taoiseach. And he felt that that was very much spun by the opposition afterwards as an attack on Saint Tony, whereas Leo Varadkar meant it as a more general attack on Neffet, the collective, and the way that the whole situation had been handled.
Yeah.
So it is a fascinating
insight. Didn't apologise to Tony Holohan when
he never apologised.
They talked about it and they fixed their relationship.
They've moved on, but there was never an apology issued. Just one other interesting on it as well, which kind of speaks to, I suppose, how all of us have operated our lives. But when you think of these guys running the country at that famous Neffet meeting, do you remember when Tony Holohan came back from leave? And this was kind of the build up. Ronan Glynn had told us a few days earlier that things were okay-ish. And then Tony arrived.
Did he suggest maybe level 3 or something?
Yeah, he was kind of in the level 2, level 3 stage of the situation. Then Tony arrived back. Things had gotten worse in the few days since, a bit like what happened last week too, is it moves very quickly, to be fair to Ronan Glynn. And then Tony Holohan obviously wants to pull the shutters down. But we learned that there was very little opposition to Tony Holohan at that Neffet meeting, but that one of those who was a bit sceptical about how far they were trying to push the restrictions was Colm Henry. But he was in a car park in West Cork with a dodgy internet reception, and he was flipping in and out of the online meeting and wasn't able to articulate his concerns that perhaps Neffet were moving too fast and that the public wouldn't, and the government indeed, wouldn't move with them. So, you know, they're real people too, living with all the problems that the rest of us have been dealing with, but perhaps not the ideal way to run a country.
Yeah. By the way, I just want to say on the, just going back to the nightclubs thing, like, we did speak to a few people yesterday who'd been out, and even those pictures on social media. I think, not to be damning all the young people, there were a lot of masks being worn in those queues. And then I think one of our contributors yesterday did say that there was, you know, that queuing at the bar thing was working and everything. So look, just so that we don't portray the whole thing as some kind of shambles or free for all. And look, hopefully it'll
all settle in. And we know that our young people have been great at uptaking the vaccine. So, you know, absolutely, it's not to blast them all. Well, a lot of the teenagers and everything.
But 20% of that, 20% of teenagers not vaccinated, isn't it? And in the 12 to 15s, it's 40, that young teenager age group, it's 40% of them not vaccinated.
Well, I suppose for that group, we still haven't given the big bonus to them of feeling there's something that makes it worthwhile for them. They're not the ones that want to get into restaurants, pubs, etc., and can't get in because they're not vaccinated. They're still able to go in unvaccinated with a parent.
Yeah, we'll have to think of a little carrot for them now. Okay, we'll think about that during the break. Nora Casey, Kevin Doyle and Dr. Ilona Duffy staying with us. Talk to you in a sec.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Texter says, Brendan, would the nighttime industry cop onto itself for all GAA matches run by Cork County Board and many other counties? But this person is clearly from flying the flag for Cork. You must book your ticket in advance. Yeah, you book theatre, cinema tickets, hairdressers, beauticians, apartments in advance. They take details for contact tracing. And that is Anne in Cork. Yeah, I suppose the thing is, Anne, you don't decide to go to a football match or to the theatre after you've had 5 points and you should go home. It's not a last minute decision usually. I think this is important here from Patricia in Dublin. There's a lot of talk about boosters for older people and healthcare workers. Very little mention of clinically vulnerable aged under 60. It's someone aged 55 who's oxygen dependent at night. I got the AstraZeneca vaccine in April and June. I'm very concerned about my protection. I bet you are, Patricia. Like, it does seem...
But she should be on the list to get a booster.
But she's on a list, but why didn't you get the booster?
Yeah, but again, back to it. We have the centres there. They're fully manned. Yeah. They're not taking from other services because they were created with new staff. Let's get people into them who need to be boosted.
Yeah. Are we going to have supply issues?
Well, we're not being told that there are supply issues, and it appears, but we don't know, do we?
You'd wonder, wouldn't you? Okay, contact tracing through WhatsApp text here. My six-year-old had a positive COVID test on Friday night. I informed 17 parents on Saturday morning on the WhatsApp group. Local contact tracing is happening, even if the HSE aren't doing it. And it certainly is. Now, Kevin, we have... It seems like there's polls every second week at this stage. So the Red Sea poll is in the Business Post today, and it's the same story as it's been recently.
Yeah, I think from the political party's point of view, the trend continues. Sinn Féin on 33%, way ahead of Fine Gael, who were down 3 to 25. Fianna Fáil way back on 12. And then you have the Greens, the other arm of government, on 4. So that's just what we've been seeing pretty much in all the polls. Different numbers, but the same. The trend is what matters really in all of that. But I think what this poll perhaps tells you is that the government, Brendan, have got more or less nothing from the budget. There's been no budget bounce for them. It was sold as the budget to counteract the rising cost of living. Okay. There was grants for students and social welfare rises and tax cuts. But 94% of people are worried about the rising cost of living. And I think the budget hasn't done much to assuage those fears.
Nora, you were looking at that as well.
Yeah, I think that there was no surprise really that there wasn't a bounce, because the reality out there, certainly, you know, the feeling on the ground is that inflation is, you know, quite high. It's highest since 2008. People are coming into the winter and the energy costs are through the roof. And yet at the same time, we're being told there might be blackouts. There's not a feel-good factor in the country at the moment. You may think because of the reopening and everything there is, I think that affects a small minority. I don't think there's a feeling in the country that we've been well run. Certain cracks are beginning, even though we were laughing at the story
about
the minister. Just let me finish this point.
But hang on, just let me say, and again, let's keep things fair here. That's one in three voters in that going for Sinn Féin. There are more than 33% for the government parties.
Yes, and I'm just saying that there isn't a feel-good factor out there as we go into the winter. You know, I don't feel, and quite apart from that survey, I don't think that people feel very confident about the economy. They don't feel very confident about their own wages, about their ability to pay for things in the future. And that may be because, you know, COVID has taken a toll on a lot of people, but I'm not surprised. That's all I'm saying, that Sinn Féin have seen that bounce.
It's weird,
and
though,
the others haven't.
On the other hand, the economy, in macro terms, like, which you would think the macro is made up of lots of micros, but in macro terms, it is, to quote Leo Varadkar, kind of taking off like a rocket.
In macro, you said it in one, you know, if you're looking at big corporates, of course they were going to take off like a rocket. But there are lots of SMEs all over the country still struggling with debt that they built up, still struggling with trying to regain the kind of profits they had before to try and pay their wages, pay their staff wages, the worry about the subsidies going out of the system. In the hospitality industry, I know loads of restaurants struggling with staff shortages. There's a big skills shortage in Ireland in that area, and they're really struggling now. They had a big bounce in the summer, and now coming into the winter, there is a lot of empty seats out there, you know, and there's a real feeling that Christmas, which we all spent double on last year, is not going to be the same this year.
And there's a feeling as well that among a lot of them, I know that if they don't get a good Christmas, it's curtains. This is the last chance for a lot of businesses, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ilona, kind of related to that, you were looking at that cover story on The Sun, and it ties into this, the cost of living. And of course, cost of living, who it affects most is people who are on fixed incomes.
Totally. And I think we are facing a winter of discontent, and there are groups who have received no bounce. And I think this is a particularly sad story. It's Tommy Malone, who's 68, and the article talks about his life and really about barely being able to eat, to put on his heat or go out. That for the last 2 years, other than his dog, he's had no company. He's trying to survive on 211 euros a week, and just talking about how difficult that is. And when we're at this stage where we have people who have medical conditions who are saying they can't turn on heat, they can't feed themselves properly and are isolated and lonely, I think it's really difficult. I mean, Alone are quoted as saying that that they had a 174% increase in 2020 in the number of people that they were supporting. That's massive, and that's older people. And I think COVID, we know, has disadvantaged them so much more, in that there was, you know, they were locked away for almost a year. And, you know, even now, things haven't really opened up enough for them. So people who maybe had supports like going to community day centres and all of those kind of things that allowed them an outlet, that allowed somebody to make sure they were doing okay, that keep all of that and give them that emotional support and psychological support, that really hasn't happened again for them.
And you see the likes of this. Places aren't open yet, are they? And you know, another thing I think is there's a lot of them are still kind of nervous about going back to mass, aren't they? Mm. And that might have been the big daily outlet.
But
for
you know,
a lot of
it's
people.
The little things. When we vaccinated last year, and we give the vaccines to our over 85s, it was shocking to see these people coming in, and many of them saying, "This is my first time to ever leave my house. It's coming in here for this vaccine." And when you saw how frail they were, because we forget that every time we're moving, lifting shopping bags, we're keeping our muscle mass up. Mm. We're actually keeping going. They had become so frail. They had, you know, really lost all that muscle tone and their ability to move, their ability to be stable and steady was gone. And I think that is ongoing. We've still haven't managed to get life back for them and to support them
fully. And the longer
it
goes on. Some of them are not going to bounce back at this stage, are they?
Oh, some of them won't, definitely. We've even seen that when we're going through our list of people we gave the vaccines to in the over 80s group, how many have died or become so home dependent that they can't even come in a wheelchair to us.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the other end of the age spectrum now. Kevin, apart from cannabis jellies, which were the big scare of this week, Squid Game is still going on as a real and present danger to our young people, and the Sunday Times are writing about it today.
Yeah, they have an interesting and perhaps almost inevitable story, because there has been this idea that don't let kids watch Squid Games, tell kids they're not allowed to watch Squid Games, and what is the inevitable fallout from that is that kids find ways to watch Squid Games. But it has transferred onto the schoolyard, and there is the Sunday Times are mentioning one school in South Dublin where they've had to write home to the parents basically saying don't allow them dress up as Squid Games for Halloween, first off, because it's entirely inappropriate. But also there is a broader concern, not necessarily at this school, but I think more generally in the system, that kids are starting to play their own version of Squid Game. And I know most people know what it is by now, but essentially it's children's games where you get shot if you lose. And that has transferred to some playgrounds in different parts of the world. And they're worried about the phenomenon coming here, that kids getting beaten up if they're losing at hopscotch or bulldog or whatever kids play nowadays in the playground. It's inevitable, though. I think there's been so much about the program.
Yeah, Squid Game's an over 15 show, like, Ilona. Mm-hmm. Kids aren't supposed to be watching it, like.
Well, it's interesting that there's any criticism of this school, because I would be thinking, my gosh, they're reminding parents of their parental responsibility. Now, I'm a mum of four. I know how hard it is. It was much easier with my elder kids because we just didn't have electronics and we didn't have the Wi-Fi. But I'm back to actually unplugging the Wi-Fi box at night in our house. But my younger child, I know that he's exposed to more than the older kids would be, because he sees what they're watching. The likes of Squid Games and things, I don't think us as parents really know half of what our children see. And I think it's a massive public health issues. So this school are saying that some of the games were being reenacted on the school ground, and kids being pushed out of the groups and really being bullied. And again, if the kids are seeing this and they see this, it becomes normal to them. And I think there's a huge body of work that needs to be done on this, what our children are being exposed to with regards to violence and sexuality at a very early stage that we as children never were exposed to.
It reminds me of being, when this is where I'm doing my old man act again, Brent. I'm not that old.
Listen, never mind the pensioners. You're never going to bounce back after the pandemic.
It reminds me of when I was young and in school and not being allowed to watch Father Ted because it had a few expletives thrown in there. I think that we've moved to a very different space with the likes of Squid Games and Netflix and everything that's available now.
Okay, and at Squid Game, we will leave it. Nora Casey, Kevin Doyle and Dr. Ilona Duffy, thank you all very much. And we're going to take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Worth mentioning that we've had a good few texts in from people who are immunocompromised who have had their jabs. And so, like, obviously a lot of people are getting them. A lot of people haven't got them. One person says, I think it depends on your consultant. But look, it obviously depends on the various circumstances.